This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we're on location. We are interviewing and talking to teacher, scholar, publisher, poet, Merrill Leffler. And here he is with an opening poem.
What we want of it. We want it to graze like gazelles and soar with the aplomb of hawks. We want it to rise like a palace out of syllables of breath. We want it to open locked gates with obscure incantations. We want it to kick down locked doors and lead us into meadows of starlight. We want it to light up the night with meteors of radiance and desire. We want it to inflame the coldness of our hearts and set passion on fire. We want it to waken the mountain gods and startle the dead from boredom. We want it to revive our ancestors and ask them for blessings. We want it to guide us through the deserts year after year and lead us to water and wild fruit. We want it to open our eyes and reveal the angels rising and descending in our own backyards.
That is the voice of Merrill Leffler, and is from a long essay, What I Want of It, about poetry, which will be published in Poet Lore.
Yeah.
And Merrill's here today to talk to us about the many worlds of writing and of publishing. He has authored two books, partly Pandemonium, partly Love, and Take Hold. Coming forth is Mark the Music. But what he's really done, in addition to that, is dedicate his life to memorializing other poets and making them permanent forevermore, and also taking some from obscurity and making us know who they are and why they lived and died. Merrill, read us another poem.
Okay, I'm going to read you a little poem called Passion. What I know of Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, though it would not fill a shot glass, is this. To study Talmud into the night, he'd stick his feet in ice water and keep them there. It was said to ward off sleep from spreading through his body. I have it on no authority, of course, but I would like to think it was his way to not forget his body while his soul set forth into the thick wilderness of God's law. Oh, Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, not even a smudge in my memory, not a pinprick in the history of the dead. I can imagine you at Matisse's table, the light holding you in place, dining on the sweet breath of life, old men wringing from each hour the honey that flows like fire in the blood. Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, for God's sakes, who knows how you might have forsaken your wife for study, or for that matter, how you came to her in dark passion, your appetite for wisdom, like Solomon's, so full you met each other with gratitude and love. Oh, Rabbi Weiss of Bilka, I drink to the memory of your feet. May they live in incandescence to light even the darkest way.
That's the voice of Merrill Leffler. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. If I were to tell you that you were a folklorist, would you be surprised to hear that?
I think I would like that. I don't know if folklorist, but tales. I love picking up tales, and so I guess that is somewhat of a folklorist. I like finding tales that seem to be wandering on their own, actually. You just come upon them. And I think in some ways that's what poetry is. You're coming upon tales that you didn't know you knew.
How did you get invested in the Hebrew tradition? I don't know if you were born into it, born Orthodox, but you have actually dedicated your life to changing a view of poetry from Hebrew and to modern time, Israelite poetry and poetry from Israel.
Yeah, I was born Jewish, raised in a Jewish family, but not Orthodox at all, not observant at all, with the remnants of that, because my parents were both from Eastern Europe. My mother was born in Poland, but they were already being assimilated. But you grow up with the stories, you grow up with the Bible as a kind of shaping narrative of your life. And so, again, while I went to synagogue, while I was bar mitzvahed, I wasn't at all religious. And it was only later on that I started getting caught up, compelled by by tales and the wisdom that it seems to me that are in folk tales.
Read the one that you sent me by email this morning.
the...
Can you find that?
Which poem did I send you this morning? This poem, it's actually not even a poem, but it's a tale. And it's a tale that it seems to me is emblematic of almost modern poetry. It begins with the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of Hasidism, the movement that was an ecstatic, I shouldn't say infatuation, but an ecstatic connection with God. The Hasidim were people who were workers, they were not scholars, and the Baal Shem Tov was a man of great devotion and a humble man and a very modest man. So here is the story that begins with him, and it's attributed, again, one of these folk tales. When the Baal Shem Tov had a difficult task before him, and this was in the 18th century, he would go to a certain place in the woods, light a fire, and meditate in prayer. Mm. And what he had set out to perform was done. When a generation later, the Maggid of Meseritz was faced with the same task, he would go to the same place in the woods and say, "We can no longer light the fire, but we can still speak the prayers." And what he wanted done became reality. Again, a generation later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sasov had to perform this task, and he went into the woods and said, "We can no longer light a fire, nor do we know the secret meditation belonging to the prayer, but we do know the place in the woods to which it all belongs, and that must be sufficient." And sufficient it was. But when another generation had passed, and Rabbi Israel of Rishon was called upon to perform the task, he sat down on his golden chair in his castle, far removed from the woods, right, and said, "We cannot light the fire. We cannot speak the prayers. We do not know the place, but we can tell the story of how it was done." And the storyteller adds, "The story which he told had the same effect as the action of the other three." So it's the telling of stories that we do, and it's the telling of stories in poetry, it's the telling of stories in folklore and in fiction. We're telling the stories of who we are.
This is Merle Loeffler, who's going to tell us his story today. I'm Grace Cavalieri. But my question to him is, how is it that this is our task? Why is it that this is our task? And do we ever complete the task, or is it a compulsive search?
Well, first of all, why we do it, it's hard to say. I have many theories, but that have to do with the need to give order to so much of the sometimes chaos and confusion. And by telling stories, in one sense, we entertain ourselves. But and those stories provide a certain kind of lift and solace. It's hard to explain why, but they do.
I know you sent me something else about Simon Ortiz and why he writes. Maybe that's a good time to interject.
Well, I love this, and in some ways I've adapted this a little bit, but Simon Ortiz was asked, "Who do you write for?" And here is what he replied. "For my sons, for my wife, for my mother and father, for my grandparents, for my aunts and uncles, for my cousins, all of them, living and dead, and then in the reverse order, so I may have a good journey on my way back home." I think the stories that we tell, they come out of our experience, but not just simply the experience of our daily lives, but the experience of where we have come from. And that is not just our mothers and our fathers, but the whole ways in which we've been raised, and in the languages that we've been raised in, and in the myths and the various stories that we have been raised in.
But why are you burning alive to dedicate your life to this? As a publisher, no one has started with so little money and done so many magnificent books. No one has made as much permanent as you have, as a single human being alone doing it, sending corrupted files back and retrieving them, making beautiful paper. Why are you driven to do this?
That I don't know. I can explain, except there is something about making something solid. You know, as poetry, for all of us who make poems, I've often felt it's the fullness of nothing. Nothing with a capital N. That it's that airy nothingness that Shakespeare refers to. That we pull words out of the air, we pull them out of our souls, out of our minds. But a book gives a habitation to all of that, a habitation that is solid. And in the making of books, and where this comes from, I don't know, because I certainly didn't grow up in this tradition. I love the quality. You, in a sense, and this may sound like hyperbole to some people, but there is an honoring of the work itself by the way that you give it that. If I say permanence, how permanent is anything? You know, it's said that Keats dressed up to meet the muse. And in one sense, you're giving a home to this work. And you want to honor that work in the best way that you can, I think.
I think it's holy work you do. And his name is Merrill Loeffler. He has made our lives richer and better for 35 years and more. Dryad Press. I think, first of all, we're going to interrupt that question just to hear another poem, and then I want to go back to what you are doing, because you're rounding out the band now, 35 and plus, and this is might be the end of Dryad this year. That's a big lie.
It's a big, we'll see.
That
we'll
was
see.
A big lie.
I keep telling myself that, but okay. It's hard to stop making these things.
But this poem exists.
Well, this is a poem called Stories, and it's related to what we've been talking about, the need to make stories. And there's an epigraph. I'll just say very briefly that epigraphs are a way of connecting yourself up with others, whether they're writers, thinkers, they come from anywhere. This is an epigraph called They Aren't Just Entertainment, Don't Be Fooled by Leslie Marmon Silko. And it goes like this. The sun has hardly sent its light over the horizon, and they are at your door clamoring, rousting you from a deep sleep. Open it at your peril. A riot could break out with no provocation, like hungry men angry for what you've got, and they'll take it if they want. Listen to them battering the air. I am your birth story, one cries. I am your abandonment story, cries another. I am your adoption story, shouts yet another, wringing its hands in anguish. I am the story of your youth, shouts one. And I, the story of your parents, cries another. I am your war story, the one you ran away from, another shouts, though it is muffled by the lust story that is out there, uncontrollable and raising hell. Up front, before me, weeping, is the marriage story and the story of their children. Next to them, the nostalgia story is swooning in despair. In the back there, dirtying the street with vituperation, are stories of regret and revenge, and near them, so many others milling around, pleading with you to listen. The story of your children's departure. The stories of affairs, of the heart and the body, the betrayal stories and the failure stories, all of them calling out, all trying to get your attention. There is the loss of power story, and out there carrying banners and parading before the house as though there was a rally are the stories of loss after loss after loss. Whispering in torment is the impotent story and the dementia story, the story of your cancer and the shrinking of your body story. Laughing hysterically is the story of your teeth. Standing together like those who have been segregated or banished are all those stories you missed. What an incredible gathering, you think, standing there, powerless, all those stories who you never had time to listen to or remember or sit up with or give comfort to. What a tumult of longing. But beyond them all is another I can hardly make out at the far edge of the crowd. It is silent, brooding, pushing its way forward slowly, determinedly. It is the story that every other is turning away from, trying to ignore, pretending they are not being pushed out of the way. It is the story they have been whispering about behind its back for years, the one that strikes fear into them, the one that suddenly stills all their wild clamoring.
What book is that going to be from?
That will be in a small book called Mark the Music that will come out maybe near the end of the year or the beginning of next year.
It's Merrill Loeffler talking, and this is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and today we're talking about the poet as publisher, the poet as teacher, and the poet as historian, really. When you started publishing, did you do it as a citizen of literature, or did you know what you were getting into, actually?
Not at all. I came to Washington in the early 60s, and I came to work at NASA as an engineer.
Oh,
and,
I forgot.
Well, that was another life. I had been writing poems. I had been writing poems mostly out of being, feeling sad and lonely and melancholy and being in the wrong work. But nevertheless, I was writing poems. They weren't just a cry or anything. I was, found myself writing poems that in quatrains and in rhymes, because I never studied poetry. My study was in physics and mathematics, and I had studied very little literature. And I didn't know anybody else who was writing poetry, except a friend from college, and he was living here. And out of the blue, and I cannot ever explain this, I don't think Neil Lehrman, who is his name, can explain this either, but we didn't know anybody else, and we said one day, why don't we start a magazine? Literally. And originally our thought was that we would mimeograph it. He had an uncle who was a CPA, and they had a mimeograph machine. But as I started looking into all of this, I knew nothing about printing. I mean, absolutely nothing, or design. We started advertising for poems, and in 1967, I remember going down to the printer. I mean, I pasted up everything myself, rubbed on letters for titles. In those days, there was something called Letraset, and to make nice looking titles. And we started Dryad Magazine, poetry magazine, in 1967. Not knowing at all what we were doing. But it was, for me, it was my apprenticeship, because at that time in advertising for poems, we started getting them. I would write back to everyone. And it was my way of developing a language, I think, to try to understand my reactions. I'm sure I wrote some very dumb letters. But we went on, and it started out as a quarterly. That quarterly lasted maybe a year, and then it was periodic. And then after a while, I realized that there was, first of all, we had very little money. I was still in graduate school. I was an older graduate student. And I realized that we were publishing poets like Roland Flint, Myra Skleru, Rod Jellema. These are poets in this area who were wonderful writers who did not have any books. They had manuscripts. And I thought, wow, why don't we see about doing books? They'll live beyond the copyright date. We might even sell them. And this just kicked me up into another level in terms of publishing, in terms of starting to get a sense of the book as a whole.
And that is what I want to comment on, because you've always honored the book as a thing, a sacred thing that you made in collaboration with God knows what. But it is the paper you choose, the covers you choose. It has always to be a work of art and an aesthetic piece. And I think that you, as modest as you are, will have to agree. We're talking to Merrill Leffler, who is a poet, who is a publisher. And we're going to hear another poem and then go on to the new books we're looking at on my table today from Dryad Press.
I'll give a little change of pace, and this is a thin line poem called The Lady and Her Shadow, and it's fun, I think. The lady had thin yellow hair. She walked with a limp and could hardly bear the sun, and so hid from the man with balloons, who had a wide, toothy, masculine grin, and, were truth known, was one of the demons of air. A fair complexion he, a bit opaque, biceps like brick, an engineer counting his data by twos and by threes, divided by the square root of whatever agrees. And this may sound silly to you, but it wasn't at all to the lady with thin yellow hair, who died of exposure not from the sun, but the leer of the man with the wide toothy grin and biceps like brick, who walked on the beach with balloons in the air and grinned at the lady with yellowy hair, who knew not enough to get up and scoot away quick like a fish out of there. I some years ago, when my younger son Daniel was in, middle school, he had to memorize the poem. And I said, well, I'll read this one to you. And then I got to the line, and this may sound silly to you. And when he realized that that was part of the poem, because he was already starting to laugh because it seemed so silly, he memorized it. And that was one of the great things at the time for me.
Is that your Ars Poetica?
I don't know.
It is the playfulness that you always have acknowledged, the whimsy and the playfulness of language and of other poets too. We have to continue on your path, because we left you as an engineer at NASA, and you mentioned graduate school, but that was at the University of Maryland College Park, where you were on the PhD track. So that was English or English literature?
It was English literature. And actually, we lived in England. I studied in England for a few years, at Maryland for a year, and then in England for 3 years, and then came back to Maryland. It was a long saga of education.
And your specialty was... Your thesis.
Well, it had to do with 19th century Delmore Schwartz, yeah. But 19th century British poetry and American literature, 19th century and 20th century American literature.
So now that we have you on that griddle, you were a teacher at Maryland.
I taught at Maryland as an instructor. Then I went on to teach at the Naval Academy in the English department.
I bet they did their homework.
They are very respectful. I mean, you could get too used to walking into a classroom and the student standing up at attention. But I taught there for 4 out of 6 years. I took a time out for 2 years to try to make a living as a freelance writer, not all that successfully. And then I left teaching full time because I went to graduate school not to become a professor. I went to graduate school to study, to read, to learn. And what I really wanted to be was someone who was writing, because when you're a writer, you're always studying. I think basically I'm a student when it comes down to it. And
when does the student become a scholar? That's the answer, right now, right here on this microphone. Merrill Loeffler is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I could not be happier. And he's going to give us another poem, a commercial break of a poem, then we'll continue his life's journey.
Okay, this is a little poem called Intercourse. A medieval rabbi, Isaac Luria, did not differentiate between organic and inorganic life, but insisted that souls were present everywhere and that intercourse with them was possible. So the poem goes like this. Thank you, say the shoes you have placed under the bed. And thank you, says the quilt, for the warmth of your skin. Thank you, says the window, for lifting my sash. And thank you, says the broom, for the grip of your hands. Thank you, says the shirt, for buttoning my sleeves. And thank you, says the pond, for throwing me stones. Thank you, says the bulb, for my planting in earth. And thank you, says the pen, for writing these lines. Thank you, says the book, for turning my page. And thank you, says the mirror, for your face each day. And thank you, says Delmore, for remembering my poems. Thank you, says the Torah, for chanting the Shema. And thank you, says my father, for the gift of your life. Mm. And my mother says likewise from the grave in my heart. And thank you, I reply, in my exit from here. Wherever I travel, you go with me there. I think that relates in some ways to Simon Ortiz's remarks about that you write, you write for yourself. John Bailey once wrote that poets write to cheer themselves up. And if they're lucky, if the poem is good enough, it'll cheer somebody else up.
This is Merrill Loeffler. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're talking about his life, actually, and the poetry that punctuates it. I think that in teaching, you bring forth much more than the lesson plan. And right now, I know that you are starting a new dimension by traveling to China and teaching ad hoc. In an ambulatory setting, and you're going to be teaching about Asian poetry.
Yeah, well, this is, it's not a major, it's become a major dimension for me in the last 6 months in studying and reading Chinese poetry in a way that I haven't. And I've been reading translations of Chinese poetry for the last 25 years, like many American poets. How can you not? I think it's had such an immense impact, the translation of Chinese poetry on our own poetry, beginning with Ezra Pound and Arthur Whaley. But I'm going on a trip to China and Tibet as part of a University of Maryland Alumni Association. So I'll be the faculty person, and I'm certainly no Chinese expert, but I will give some talks about the translation of Chinese poetry and Chinese texts, particularly Confucius, Analects, and the Tao, which have had, again, I think, a tremendous impact on our own literature. And and poets significantly, not just the poets who are translating Chinese poetry, but those translations that and the mode of that writing, which has been influential on poets like James Wright. These are some older poets: Kenneth Rexroth, Gary Snyder, Sam Hamill. Many of these are poet translators. And then they have students or they have readers. And many of these books are in printings like 10th, 15th printing. It's a register.
It's
for
exponential.
Yeah.
And I know Pound did it not as an older person, but do you think there's something about getting on in age in our career where we tend toward simplification? The thing I feel that I need it more than I ever did before. The serenity, the quiet at the center, the Asian poem, which we've always respected. But don't you think your thirst for it is new?
I think it's, for me, it's gone in cycles. I know when I was younger, it's really interesting. When I would get bottled up, I was getting so much into my own head when I couldn't write, I would sit down with William Carlos Williams's poems. And there was it seemed like he cleared so much out of the way and just listen to what's there, or see what's there. When he said, no ideas but in things, some people sometimes read it, no ideas but things. That's not what he said. He wrote, it was no ideas but in things. It's not that there aren't ideas in the poetry, but there is a clearing out of the way of all the static that we're surrounded, surrounded by. The Asian poems, these Chinese poems, there is a simplification, and it seems to me that, at least in a number of the poets that I've been reading, what I love is what James Wright called the pure, clear line. And often they're poems not so much of memory, but they're poems of the now. They're written in the present tense, not just going back to what was and making an epiphany of all of that. Mm. We're trying to, and of course, any writer does that, can't help that. But it's where we are now. And of course, a lot of those Asian poems or Chinese poems, we'll be reading poems of men who, and some women too, in their when they're older. But it's not just that. They're writing poems to each other. There is a wonderful clarity and simplicity that just reminds me once more, it gives pleasure and lift, but also helps me clear through so much of the clutter.
What Merrill Loeffler has brought to many of us who are in the poetry community is the fact that the poem is a blessing. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location today. We're talking to Merrill Loeffler. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're back now with Merrill Loeffler, and he's going to read us another poem.
Okay, well, I'm going to read you a poem called Farewell, and it's in quatrains. That's all I have to say about that. Well, I would say one other thing, that there are poems that you love that have a certain mystery, not because you do that deliberately, but because you're following a line, and here it is. It's called Farewell. In these faces, it is always farewell. You may see yourself here or not. You may walk a straight line to hell and arrive through the front door, or knock without thinking at the back. You may be schooled in caution like a spy and count every step and still backtrack into the arms of the enemy. You may crawl on your knees for 100 years and engrave a yellow star on your breast. You may try and cover your fears and pretend that you have come to a rest. Dear friends, we are traveling this way alone. Finally, there are no lies. Minute by minute, day by day, each life is a blessing, each blessing a disguise. And it's not that one always understands one's poems. I have to tell you that little poem about the lady in her shadow, the one who walked on the beach, originally when I published that, I called it a parable with an undefinable meaning. I really didn't understand. Standard. The poem seems to me have lots of meaning now, and I've called it The Lady and Her Shadow, but at the time I really didn't. I was just almost in a trance.
Have you read Pinter's Nobel Prize winning speech, where he says he starts a play with one word? He started a play with the word dark, had no idea where it was going to go, and another play was started with the word Where Are the Scissors? And that's really the way a poem starts, isn't it?
Well, sure. You're more interested in what you don't know than what you do know. I mean, I'm not saying anything that any poet wouldn't say, that you want to see what you're going to discover.
I have on this desk 3 new books. How many books has Dryad put out altogether? 50? Or 100?
About, no, not 100. About, it's, I've not really counted them, but I think it's close to 50, mm-hmm. about 50 books.
All blood all over them.
A lot of blood.
And but, the new ones that I'm looking at right now all have one common theme. Would you tell us that?
Well, they're books that relate to the Jewish experience during the war. We often say the Holocaust, but it's, you know, that's become an abstraction, and it doesn't mean any, you know, it doesn't mean anything anymore. It seems to me, other than, I'm not sure what it means. It's the stories that matter, and the books that manuscripts that have come my way tell these powerful stories, and there are so many of, you know, there are so many stories out there. There are so many books that have come out of survivor, you know, people who have survived the most impossible kinds of lives. One of the recent books that we just, I say a recent book, is out in the last month, and I'll just add a plug in that it's distributed, I published it, but it's a Dryad Press book. I published it in association with the University of Wisconsin Press, which is distributing the book to the trade. It's called 1,111 Days in My Life Plus Four by Ephraim Sten. And very briefly, during the war, Ephraim and his family lived in a small town in eastern Poland, which is now in the Ukraine. And he and his mother and a number of other Jews were hidden by a Ukrainian Catholic family for close to 3 years. During that time, I mean, that in itself is an amazement, but during that time, the teenage, you know, Ephraim kept a journal in Polish, because that was his language, and it was a rather precocious boy, but it was over a period of 3 years. Let me just continue very quickly. He remained in Poland, where he was educated, but in 1957, he finally left Poland and went to Israel. Married, had a family, was an Israeli broadcasting, radio broadcaster, and arts, and then in the 80s, translated it, the Polish into Hebrew so that his children could read of his experiences. In the 90s, he went back to that village where he grew up in and where he was hidden, and had always remained in touch with the man who had, you know, had saved them. And in going back and revisiting that life of 50 years before, when he came back to Israel, he sat down with his journal, which was now in Hebrew. So it's gone from Polish to Hebrew. He started responding as a grown man 50 years later to each of those entries. And Ephraim, who unfortunately died of cancer about a year and a half ago, and who I knew, this book was translated by Moshe Dor, whose first language is Hebrew, whose second language is English, but he is the most extraordinary translator to go from, and this is his second language.
Because he's a poet.
Yes, he is a poet.
I've asked you to read just two diary entries. So what I understand is this is a double narrative with the original words in the diary and then the man 50 years later commenting on his own words from the other view, from his adulthood. So I've chosen just the first one of the first entries, July 18th, and then one entry 1,000 days later, just so we can hear the kind of, the fact that he could continue writing is the amazing thing. I have three squares a day and I can hardly write.
This is July 18th, 1941. This is the teenage Ephraim. This morning, a frightened Mrs. Reichardt arrived and told us German soldiers were robbing Jews. At once, Heinz picked up his rifle and settled down at the gate. He said he would kill any robbing soldier on the spot because a soldier is forbidden to rob. It's not right for a soldier to do that. Nobody came to us. Perhaps they saw Heinz and were afraid, or it was just the gang that arrived and then left. 50 years later, here is Ephraim. No gate, no house, nothing has remained. A monument of Pushkin sprouted in our courtyard instead of a lilac bush. Surely Heinz must have vanished too. How odd it is, but that he's the only German among all those I ran into that the diary mentions positively. Blonde, faded, thin, a bit bent, and a bit sad, I doubt he found his place in the other New Germany. That Germany where a newspaper headline declared, "Killing Jews by gas is a victory of economic principles," says a senior German officer. Of course, he's right. Just think of the price of millions of bullets and how happy it makes one, the fact that there's something stable left in the changing world. And then July 12, 1944, we're talking 3 years later. I haven't written for almost a week. Why? I don't know. Maybe because I lack willpower. Every day I promise myself that I would write, and in vain, and there's lots of news. On Sunday morning, the soldiers who were living with us went off, so the news from the radio was heard at 10 p.m. on Saturday. Vilna is surrounded, Lida is liberated, and a huge offensive is going on near Kowel. Finally, near to us, indeed, we hear constant artillery. Sometimes the fire, like at this very moment, is sparse. Sometimes, particularly in the evenings, it's very dense. Now here's Ephraim in the 90s, commenting on that entry. I remember there was something encouraging in the thunder of cannons, and it's no paradox that it contained hope, the tidings of freedom, delivery from prison, new life. There's nothing more beautiful than a nightly aerial attack, particularly when one identifies with the bombers despite being on Earth among the attacked. The sky is black, full of the noise airplanes make, which resembles the rattle of sewing machines. That's the nickname the Germans gave the Soviet night bombers. Blinding flares descend from the sky, spreading a bluish cold light. It's tax-free profit when they fall nearby. One picks up the parachutes and sews shirts of the white nylon. When the bombs fall far from us, their threatening voice sounds dim and prolonged. If they're near, we hear crescendo of an approaching whistle mounting in strength, a pause, and a blow-up. All the glasses drop and shatter, and the table is our only shelter. It's not strange at all that we don't think of the hit, the destruction. What matters is that the Germans get it. I'll just add one little note that comes out of the diary. During those 1,111 days of my life, the old Ephraim wrote, under a dark sky, the heart atrophied and turned into a mere weight. Very powerful, dark in many ways, because what he had buried for all these years in his confronting the diary that he had written as a boy. You can't revise your memories because the memories were there of that period.
He died in 2004 of cancer.
Yeah.
One wonders how you stay alive that long.
Well, it's hard to know. But it's always a miracle to me. We published another book, They'll Have to Call Me First, by Irene. I've read. It's called An Artist's Coming of Age in the Third Reich.
They'll have to catch
me first.
You have to learn the books you're publishing.
They'll have to catch me first. An Artist's Coming of Age in the Third Reich. Irene and her husband were incarcerated in a little-known camp called Mechelen, which is in Belgium. It was a transport camp in which thousands of Jews and gypsies were sent east to labor camps and mostly to Auschwitz, where they died. Irene and her husband, the man who became her husband, were artists who were employed. They were slaves there, where they had to paint numbers for people to wear, for the prisoners to wear around their necks. In the meantime, they were surreptitiously doing drawings. That compelling need, you asked before, Grace, why do we write? Is that compelling need to make, to shape, to give order, to we're people, we're a species that needs to make, I think. And I think one of the, I think when people are making, there is a certain joy, a certain pleasure that is just wonderful.
There, before we continue with that book, just to mount on that idea, there is a spiritual principle that artists bring forth a lot of light from the universe through their crowns, and they bring in too much light. And therefore, the human form cannot handle it. So it has to spill over into products. Oh. So we have products and products, and we have to keep writing book reviews. We have to keep writing because we have all this damn light. And otherwise, we will burn out. I mean, it will short circuit, right?
I love that.
So this woman was in drawing these things, and she met her husband. She never knew that the people she was forced to draw portraits of German Nazi soldiers. But then the children that were there in this stopover station, she didn't know that their fate was that they would be gassed after leaving there, or she said she could not have done
it. Right.
And that is, this book is remarkable for, first of all, the pictures in it.
Yeah, we've been able to reproduce the color paintings that Irene and a couple of other artists who were at Mechelen did, and Irene actually rescued them. The day after liberation, the prisoners were liberated. She went back to Mechelen, to that prison camp, the next day and retrieved whatever she could find. Of course, the portraits and the paintings that they did for the Nazis naturally were all gone.
She talks about the sadness in the eyes of the children that she was painting, and she didn't even have the understanding of the scope at that time. But what I thought was more interesting was that in later years, a scholar from Mechelen never knew that camp was there. If ever we need a publisher like Dryad Press to put these things out, a man lived in that village and never right. knew that station was there. That just stopped my heart. It was so horrifying. And now I knew that your writing, your work is against subjugation. Your publishing is against subjugation. And that's what you're doing, Merrill Loeffler.
Well,
so take that.
Okay.
I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're going to go on. I think we need a poem, don't you think, to catch our breath?
Well, we'll do a little poem here. This is a poem called Limits. And actually, I've done the poem twice. We'll see if we have enough time because, as you will hear, this is the first part, and there is an epigraph again, as there will be for the second part. In the first part, it goes like this. Even God has problems. I'm not sure how we can help him. This is by Abraham Heschel, a wonderful scholar, a man who marched with Martin Luther King, you know, in the South, a great humanist. Here's the poem, Limits. Here, says God, the author of us all, you are my invention. What can I say, he says, I too am limited in what I can create. Once I had an idea and worked like a poet driven mad by dreams, delighted like every god before me. With such powers, I imagined a brave new world and took it on with gusto. What hubris! After all, how much can I do? I also get writer's block. I too get depressed. I too have limits and am condemned to repeat myself. Meanwhile, you bother me with your petty agonies. What about me? I too could use some pity. A bit of empathy on your part wouldn't hurt. For God's sake, what would you be without me, without even my dullest idea? Enough already. I have given you the outline. You make the plot. Go, Gollum. Travel as you will. I wash my hands of you. You are no longer my business. P.S. If you like, you can keep in touch. Now, the second part, I'm going to read this because I feel this is now part of this poem. And it has an epigraph from Baudelaire. God is the only being who, in order to rule, does not need even to exist. Mm. Here, says God, the author of us all, you are my invention. What can I say, he says, I too am limited in what I can create. Once I had an idea and worked like a poet driven mad by dreams, delighted like every god before me. With such powers I imagined a brave new world and took it on with gusto. What hubris! After all, how much can I do? I also get writer's block. I too get depressed. I too have limits and am condemned to repeat myself. Meanwhile, you bother me so with your petty agonies. What about me? I too could use some pity. A bit of empathy on your part wouldn't hurt. For God's sakes, what would you be without me, without even my dullest idea? Enough already. I have given you the outline. You make the plot. Go, Gollum. Travel as you will. I wash my hands of you. You are no longer my business.
What does Gollum mean?
I should have said this beforehand. A Gollum is a creature that is made out of clay through mystical incantations. It's one of those marvelous legends that go back to ancient times. And there's a great story of the Gollum that was created in the 18th century to protect the Jews in Prague. But that is another story. But a golem is a created creature that comes, that is brought to life, cannot speak, is mute, but through the magical incantations with the mysteries of language.
I'm glad you used the word incantations, because I think that that is one thing that you have restored to contemporary poetry, our love for the incantation. The poet Eitan. You have translated him from Hebrew. You did,
yes,
the Hebrew.
Yes, Moshe Dor and I have translated him.
And he writes somewhat like Pablo Neruda in his roaring, it's not a diatribe, it's a roar against war, but it is incantation.
It's incantatory.
Yeah.
And oracular. And it's the sense of the poet or the poem. I often focus not so much on the poet. You know, as D.H. Lawrence said, trust the tale, not the teller. When the poet is making that poem, the poem itself comes alive. And then when you're not making the poem, I often don't think the poet is any different than anybody else, but it's in the making of the poem, and it's the poem that lives, and it's the poem that carries the power, not the poet. The poet is a vehicle in many ways.
The poet is the genius of his own household, as Reed Whittemore actually was considering that for the title of his William Carlos Williams book, Poet from Jersey.
Right.
That was one of his first titles. And the reason I'm sagging into that is that you are now taking our venerable and wonderful American poet, Reed Whittemore, and doing his new book, his memoir. And tell us, first of all, who he is and what you think you're doing.
Reed Whittemore is, I think, one of our great treasures, or his poetry is one of our great treasures from the 50s through the 80s and 90s, actually. He was poet laureate, although in those days, in the 60s, it was called Consultant of Poetry in the Library of Congress. He stepped in again in 1985. He was the poet laureate of Maryland for several years. But those are awards. Those are the accoutrements. His work is work that deals with American culture, and in a voice that I think is really very distinctive in our time. It's a voice that is strong with feeling, but that can also be satiric, can be ironic, that gets angry, that can get bitter. But it's essentially a voice that's rooted in a caring for the, you know, for what our ideals are, not just American ideals, but what we should be trying to live up to, but not in a didactic way at all.
What is the title of this?
It's Reed Whittemore, The Literary Life of a Poet. And we're hoping to have it, not hoping, I will have it out by the end of the year. We're planning for a fall publication. And I think it'll be a wonderful book. Reed was very much of a little magazine man. The reason we have we've had a coordinating council of literary magazines in this country is in the 60s was primarily through his dogged getting this through with a lot of contentiousness during the late 60s and early 70s. And Reed was the founder, publisher of Furioso, a great renegade magazine before the war, and then he reimagined it after the war. The Carlton Miscellany, Delos, which was a magazine of translation. He's a poet of the people, I think.
He began the populism of the poetry magazine, and I think he was the chief authority on the small magazine in America. And now, of course, it's dissolved. The crest has gone down.
Yeah.
The wave has fallen. But I think when he was at the Library of Congress, remember that conference he gave on the small magazine?
Right, right.
He's America's foremost authority on that phenomenon. And you are a presenter of poets. And if I keep asking you why, you will never know. But I think it's because, in a way, we want to put them out in front of us. I mean, we're almost like naked in a dream. And if we put all those poets out in front of us, we'll get said what needs to be said somehow for us, maybe.
And it's but one of the essential roles of the poet, it seems to me, has to do with language. You know, in Confucian thinking, this is going to the Chinese work that I've been immersing myself in, it's the rectification of names. It's if you don't have if the language is not right, then society, a culture is not right either. And the role, the responsibility of poets, among not just poets, but of poetry, is to be keeping the language alive, to keep it from dissolving into the cliches and to the kinds of words that don't mean anything that can be used to persuade and to move people in ways through rhetoric for its own sake.
Like politics.
Like politics, of course.
And like commercials and like television and fake stuff. You mentioned language and you mentioned translation, and so I just want to take a very short time to ask you the process of changing something from a language to a literal level and then what you do with it. So you can do that with Hebrew if you wish, or you can do it with the Asian poetry.
Well, my experience is really with the Hebrew. And when I say I translate with Moshe Dor. One, because Moshe does literals, and there are different levels of literals. Moshe has a wonderful command of English. But I don't think, for me personally, other poets operate differently. I would not be able to put my name on a translation if I could not read Hebrew and if I could not hear the lines in Hebrew when I read them out loud and if I didn't have some vocabulary and some grammar. This is to say that I couldn't do it from scratch. I couldn't do it without Moshe, you know, when I say Moshe's literals, and so I take his literal, I've taken his literals, I've gone through each line of each poem using my dictionary when I don't know the words, trying to, as much as one can, you know, a translation is not, is a translation, it's a poem in our own idiom. And then I go back and sit with Moshe and we then go over the Hebrew and go over what I've done, you know, with my coming at his literals, or in some cases retranslating my understanding of, you know, of a line or lines within a poem. And it can sometimes be a painful process.
You have to like the other guy a lot.
I love Moshe. I love Moshe.
I can't imagine.
Cantankerous, but I love him.
But a collaboration like that is a marriage, and we all know what a compression that is.
Right.
We would love to hear something different from you, and I know that you have a great spectrum. And I read a new poem of yours, The People on the Block, and I think we're rounding the bend so that we would love to hear this.
Okay, well, this is called The Building on Our Block, and while it takes up a few pages, the lines are very thin, and it propels itself through rhyme, through internal rhyme, and I hope narrative interest. There is a little epigraph which will make sense as this goes on. It's in 10 parts, and there are different voices, as you will see or hear. And the epigraph is, "Don't give us poems of unspeakable lives if you can't make the words bleed." So each section is a different person. So this is Mrs. Green. Old Mrs. Green, grinning at her third floor window, cried sharply, "Don't speak to me of maybes or might have been. Speak to me of lovers running naked through fire. My memory is alive with desire." Stewed, pitiful in her cups, they all agreed. Blue, that is, and Mrs. Orange living next door in Prim. Miss Yellow on the second floor, and Mr. Brown, who merely nodded on the park bench that fall when the leaves were changing yet again, and the breezes lifted them aloft while young mothers rolled strollers past him. Mr. Brown, invisible now, once had ladies in his thrall. "All of you are living the lie," screamed old Mrs. Green from her window up there. "How can you remember what you lost when you forgot to remember?" she cried to no one everywhere. Poor old Fracture, down for the count, they nodded, drank tea, and ate oatmeal cookies passed out by Mr. Gray, the super, that last afternoon of old Mrs. Green on our block. 2. Mrs. Brown. Mrs. Brown's gone down underground, dead. They all gathered once more at Mrs. B's door. Mrs. Orange wanted to cry, and though she tried, the best she could do was a longish sigh. Miss Yellow could not speak. Her heart, she said, was much too weak. "I'll have no part in this," said Madam Red from her bed on the second floor. "Don't mourn for me," Mrs. Brown once said when she was feeling grim, and once again when she was feeling light and free. "When you're dead, life's just a show, stagehand or star, over and over again, it's the same old play." Mr. Brown sat in the park until dark and fed breadcrumbs to the birds. "I'm all words," he muttered to himself, "words, words, and more words." Mr. Black. "I don't know what we want of life. It's filled with grace and filled with strife. When my wife left, my light went out, and what's left of it? I've seen more than I need to see. There's no and nothing left for me. My wife's gone. My kid's gone bad. I could have been driven mad. But here I'm at. I've done nothing wrong, and I'm nowhere that I belong. On the street, I'm yesterday's news. Some say that's Black singing his blues." Mm-hmm. Mrs. Orange. "I was pretty once," Mrs. Orange wept. "Great gams," Mr. O once said, "so long ago when we were fresh and I was new. My chin's gone now, my cheeks sag. Oh, what's the use," she said over hot tea one bright afternoon. "Everything creaks. Mr. O's gone. Good riddance. I should have sinned more that time behind the kitchen door when Blue grabbed at my waist and bent down to kiss my breast. I was wet inside and could have cried for the pleasure of it all. And Mr. Brown once gave me sweets and things, came pleading that we go to bed. Look at him feeding pigeons in the park. He might as well be dead." "You should have sinned," they all joined in. "You should have sinned. You should have sinned." Here is Blue's song. "Bomb the bastards, bomb the bastards, bomb the bastards, bomb. Bomb the bastards, bomb the bastards, bomb the bastards, bomb." Miss Yellow. Miss Yellow, sickly sweet, prim, proper, pinched, looks down a lot. Lived with Mama 40 years, who up and left Miss Y behind. She's weak of heart, and says and plays a small part on the block, says Mr. Gray. Locked behind her door, she sings in the choir in her mind, and sends her prayers aloft each night, and never cries like Mrs. Orange, or screams like Mrs. Green, or laughs at life like Mrs. Brown once did. She never says, I should have, nor I should not have. See Miss Yellow sit. Once, long ago, she had fun, but has no memory of it. Mrs. Blue. Mrs. Blue worked hard and did all that she was taught to do. Cleaned the house, made the beds, cooked the meals, raised the kids. Her house spotless, no mess for her. You could if you chose to eat from her floor. But Mr. B was never there, even when he was. And that's the sad short tale of Mrs. Blue. Let the tenants cry, boo-hoo, boo-hoo. Madam Red. Madam Red receives visitants in her bedroom and special visitors in her bed. I can view the days ahead, she says, and what the future holds for you and you and you, for Blue and poor Miss Yellow, and Mrs. O on the floor below. I was once with Mr. O, it was no good, nor Mr. Brown, soft as he was in both heads, and Blue was all beery talk, but that's been long ago and gone. We're all done, friends, we're all done. That's the future that I see, and what I see is what I see. Mr. Gray. I seen it all, says Mr. Gray, the super. Yeah, I seen it all, even what I ain't, and I seen plenty. Mr. Brown, for one, he collected rents and was a good time man until he went impotent with Mrs. B when he was 40, then turned soft like putty. How do I know what I know? Maybe I'm like Madam Red, who sees the future from her bed and takes one man after another there, like Mr. O once, and even Blue, who didn't know what to do. He liked his beer and kept his missus in her place, who walked in fear of him. And Mrs. O, now she was a looker once, and wanted more than she ever got. She's not right up there. Something's dim. It wasn't always so. Oh, it's a grim block. Grim. Miss Yellow, triple locked behind her door, and Mrs. G, she was a howler night and day, day and night. And Black, he suffered more than most. There's more, of course, but we all know the score. That's all, said Mr. Gray, the super. That's all there is to say. Mr. Elscoda. This is the end of our small play. Let's away, away, as in Shakespeare's day, and find new players and another stage to laugh and storm and strut and rage. So that's the apartment on our block.
That is the voice of Merrill Leffler. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Merrill Leffler has been visiting us today, and his work is of the determination and the dignity of man. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on location. Our series is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. You can hear these programs on www.loc.gov/poetry, Poet and Poem. The series is brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation in Poetry. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Thank you.